The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Bragging Rights Special. Evertonians will be sticking it to their colleagues all over the Zoom meetings of Merseyside today after winning at Anfield for the first time since 1999. Will detectives Ancelotti and Ferguson solve the puzzle of how to finish higher than seventh? In North/East London, West Ham yell mind the gap to sorry Spurs. The Hammers in the Champions League spots while Tottenham have lost 5 in 6. Jose says there are problems which he can't resolve. That's reassuring. Elsewhere, Man City win a training game 1-0. Leicester are still good. Fulham close in on Newcastle. We ask, what precisely was Carl Darlow doing for that penalty? Also, some big results in Europe, a total mess in the National League, and some important news on the Dalai Lama. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max.
Mark Langdon from the Racing Post, hello.
Hello, Max.
Barney Ronne, how are you?
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Yes, good, thanks very much. Let's start then at Anfield, shall we? Liverpool 0, Everton 2. Everton win at Anfield for the first time in 22 years. Their first win over Liverpool in 24 meetings in all competitions. 4 home defeats in a row now for Liverpool against Burnley, Brighton, City and now Everton. It was all worth it, Barry, wasn't it, for Duncan Ferguson just grabbing Seamus Coleman by the ears and saying, I love you, son. We've done it.
Yeah, it's the nearest Everton have got to lifting a trophy recent years, hoisting Seamus Coleman aloft by the ears. I really enjoyed the game. It's a great win for Everton, who were just much better organised than Liverpool, thoroughly deserved their win. That, you know, Jurgen Klopp claimed afterwards that God and the weather were conspiring against them, and I suppose some fans will think the referee had it in for them because of the controversial penalty, but I don't think that made much of a difference in the end. Everton were worthy winners, and Liverpool are in, you know, you're just wondering how much gas is in this explosion at this stage.
And what did you make of it, Barney?
Well, it was just a continuation of what we've seen recently. It's really hard. It is hard to draw. It's hard to draw wider conclusions on what's happened to Liverpool. Is Klopp actually a fraud? Does it all count for nothing when, you know, they've obviously got real problems with their squad depth and the injuries? If people say it's boring to go on about the injuries, but people go on about the injuries because it's true. What's been interesting this season is Klopp has really turned out to be absolutely wedded to his way. The decision to destroy his own midfield in order to reman his defence, in retrospect, looks like a terrible decision. Not being willing to trust the centre halves he has actually pulled his own team to pieces, and they've totally lost all momentum. And it's kind of quite shocking to see. I was completely intoxicated by Liverpool last year. I really did think this is one of the greatest club teams I've ever seen. And the contrast now is really quite shocking. And I kind of hate seeing Klopp now. I hate seeing him on the sidelines. I find it quite upsetting. I find his tortured smile and his body language and his inability to accept what's happening to him really quite sort of one of the strange things of the lockdown and the pandemic. And it's this kind of public theatre that I wish that I was seeing the same level of total self-doubt and being totally lost in Boris Johnson. I wish Boris Johnson was appearing. But it seems that the effect of this lockdown has been to make these things happen to Jurgen Klopp, who I really like and think is an honest, decent person, and who seems completely baffled by the limitations of his own ability to manage the situation. But yeah, it's not Matt Hancock, it's not Boris Johnson who's having this public meltdown. It's Jurgen Klopp, which I find quite sad, and I wish it was the other way around.
What does he need to do to turn it around, do you think?
Well, I don't think they can turn it around now. I wonder if Klopp is finished at Liverpool now. I mean, he's been there for quite a long time. He's built a brilliant team. They've won everything. They don't have endless financial resources. It's very, very hard to build a second team when you've stopped that process. They didn't build from a position of strength. They did sign a few new players, signed Diogo Jota. But I wonder if that's it, if it's time to go and use his brilliant gifts somewhere else. If at some point the players stop stop doing what you want them to do, or just simply can't do it anymore. Everyone gets tired. And that's how I feel about them now, looking at them, which is sad. It doesn't deny the brilliance of what they've achieved or how great that team was or what a great manager Klopp is, but everything has a natural cycle.
Mark, what do you reckon?
I think I'd like to see that sort of, in terms of Klopp, I'd like to see that collapse happen with, you know, the centre-backs fit, because I do think that, and it's a really unusual season having to play, you know, every 3 days, and you know, there was very little break in between. I think if this was happening in a normal campaign, I'd maybe go down that route. Given it's not, I would give Jurgen Klopp and sort of most managers, I think, a bit more leeway, just in terms of trying to manage what is, you know, a football season in a pandemic. I do think there are some issues, and that sort of you know, Plan B, making sure that Plan A works, is something that Jurgen Klopp and a lot of the best managers, you know, is what they do. And I do wonder whether, you know, Firmino is somebody up front when Liverpool are playing really well, he's perfect for that system because he becomes the extra man in midfield, he starts to press, he links everything together. When they're not doing that, he kind of looks a bit lost as that centre forward. And, you know, if he's not creating the space for Mane and Salah, and you just want to sling a cross in from Robertson or Alexander-Arnold, he's maybe not the best person for that. And you're looking on the bench thinking, well, how does he change that dynamic going forward? And, you know, Origi has scored some big goals for Liverpool in the past, but he's not somebody that you want to be relying on for any significant amount of time, I wouldn't have thought, if you want to, you know, win the Premier League back to back. So,
were you surprised that they signed Kabak, you know, given how much Bundesliga you watch? And are you unsurprised that, you know, he hasn't just walked in and been brilliant, because he was at, what, Schalke, who went 1-30?
He was somebody last season that was quite highly rated. This camp, and he was a bit rash for Schalke, even when he was doing well. He's very much sort of on the front foot as a defender, and he's had two really difficult games in terms of the Premier League. I mean, making your debut against Leicester with Barnes and Vardy making that same run in behind you it must be a bit of a nightmare, really. And then you know, Richarlison's a very clever player, and then Dominic Calvert-Lewin, when he came on, he wasn't on for that long, but he completely bossed him, you know, for the time that he was on the pitch. So I'm not surprised that they signed him, because if you look at it, it's quite a Liverpool type signing, where somebody maybe had lost their value, had dropped significantly, and you take a chance that maybe it's everybody around him at Schalke that's the issue rather than the defender himself. And it may well be the case, and you know, you get that option to try before you buy. There's not much you can do in January anyway, so I'm not sure that it was you know, a terrible signing. He clearly hasn't settled very well at the moment, but he's still a centre back, and that is somebody that should, in theory, allow those midfielders, when they're fit, to go back into their natural position. And there'll be easier games than Leicester and Everton. Everton were really aggressive and always looked a threat on the break, and I think they deserved the win as well.
Yeah, lots of good performances from them. Michael says, is Tom Davis the most aesthetically pleasing player in the world? Not by the way he plays, which is beautiful in its own way, but in terms of how he actually looks. Beard, hair, beautiful blue eyes, non-existent shin guards, dirt on his shorts inside the first minute. Gorgeous. He had a super game, Barry, I thought.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of him as a player, but he's struggled. I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's injuries or just not getting picked on a regular basis, but he's struggled to make himself a regular in that team. And he was hugely impressive in that game. I mean, him and Abdoulaye Doucouré in midfield. Doucouré was okay, wasn't brilliant by any stretch of the imagination, but Davis really, really bossed it.
Barney?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Davies is a very handsome man, obviously, which I think seems to be generally the thrust of the kind of listener question. Yes, yeah, he's hot. But he kind of seems like such a nice guy. And, you know, I love those pictures of him and Calvert-Lewin in New York. They just made me think of Simon and Garfunkel in 1963 having a wonderful kind of friendship and travelling around on Greyhound buses and riding bicycles and all that kind of stuff. And I thought they seem like incredibly nice footballers and just sort of nice young men. And I hope they stay playing at Everton, doing quite well and finishing sixth for the rest of their careers and have a lovely time.
Barry, you saw, I mean, we all saw the some guy called Nathan Pickering was wandering. Where was he? He was in Bold Street, which is somewhere in Liverpool, I presume. Him and Tom Davis and Leighton Baines buying homeless fellas drinks. I presume coffees. I don't know. But anyway, it was a nice thing to do.
Why did you presume coffees? I presumed it was cans.
No, I don't know. It was quite early in the morning. I mean, I suppose it doesn't make a difference necessarily. I presumed it was coffees. I don't know either way.
Buy homeless people beverages of any kind is a very kind gesture and fair play to them.
One part of this game that I really enjoyed was obviously not Jordan Henderson getting injured, but when they cut to the bench and Nat Phillips had committed himself to taking his tracksuit bottoms off over his boots, and they clearly weren't getting over his boots. And you just, you know, we've all been there when we're like, I'm just so lazy, I can't be asked to take my shoes off, and I'm going to try and get these trousers off over my shoes. I don't know why I want to do that sometimes, but I do.
In the bedroom when Mrs. Rushton is feeling frisky?
Yeah, we have a shoes on policy, Barry.
God, that's disturbing.
What's the limit for Everton, Mark? Where could Everton get? You know, we talk about the Everton Cup being seventh place. They are seventh now. What do you reckon?
Well, I think that, you know, they are in this hunt for a Champions League spot. If you have a look at sort of recent results, they got the draw at Old Trafford, played okay against Manchester City. I don't, you know, they deserve to lose, but didn't play terribly in that game. And now they've just won away at Anfield, so they have to be considered in that top four battle. I don't think that they will get there, but it's clearly improvement on sort of other recent campaigns. They are at least in the mix. It's so tight between kind of that fourth to about seventh or eighth that you could still finish seventh or eighth and not do that much wrong, just the way that the season's going. But I think wherever Everton finish, they'll feel like they're heading in the right direction. They're in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup. You know, they've just won at Anfield. They are at least in the mix for top four or top six.
Also, in the mix are West Ham, officially the best team in London. Only lost once in 2021, 1-7, drawn 1. Jesse Lingard scored 3 goals in his 4 league games for West Ham, won a penalty as well. Finnegan writes, Barney, West Ham question from a West Ham supporter that neither I or any of my West Ham supporting friends can answer. How are West Ham good?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, West Ham should be good. I mean, this was the whole point about the move to the new stadium, that they were going to, I mean, the idea was that they had an enormous revenue from the number of people coming in through the gates every week, and that would therefore catapult this team into the Champions League spaces. I mean, the funny thing that's happened is nobody's coming in through the gates, but this has indeed still happened. I mean, what's happened is David Moyes has done a brilliant work with the players. I mean, he personally scouted, recommended and brought in, for example, Souček, who obviously is having a great season. He's a manager who, you know, the move to Man United made people forget that he's actually very good at organising football teams. I was there at his unveiling at West Ham the first time, and it was really touching. He was in this kind of suite high up in the stadium, and he tried so hard to put it. He made his face smile in a way that his face doesn't normally smile. He tried so hard to be positive and to say, this is going to work. And it was almost as though he'd like winched his face into this smile with that butterfly clips. And that's not what David Moyes is about. Like, David Moyes is all about the eyes. He's all about the piercing eyes. He's all about the kind of the frown, the steady glare, the simplicity, the no nonsense. And that's how his team are now. They play a really straightforward way. They've got that brilliant midfield pivot. Really, he's decided exactly what he wants in there, and it's working brilliantly. And I just think it's maybe a season where a sensible, no frills, well organised manager can get the best out of his team, and it's very hard not to feel very pleased for David Moyes.
Padre says, "What would Gandhi make of Lingard's celebrations? Big hammer is Mahatma. It's so good to see Lingard Mark being happy, scoring goals, you know, surrounded by teammates who clearly like him. He's settled in so quickly. He seems very positive and happy there after what wasn't a great time at United for a while.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, he was part of that England team that reached the semi-finals of the World Cup. And I mean, he was somebody that had been highly rated by Sir Alex Ferguson and, you know, really admired the his ability to run from deeper positions, which is where he got the goal against Spurs. And then whether it, you know, I think he's spoken about some sort of personal issues and then just completely, you know, was unable to, completely frozen out at Manchester United. I think there's a difference between, you know, playing for Manchester United and West Ham, and maybe sometimes it can suit you to play for a team like West Ham where you do get a run of games and you won't be overly criticised. It's not a massive deal if you go a few games without scoring or assisting a goal, as was sort of one of the issues that Lingard had. And you know, it's a different kind of pressure when you're playing there, and it looks like he's just having real fun at the moment. And his goals have been really important for West Ham. I mean, the fans will absolutely love that he's got the winner against Spurs, but the against Aston Villa, I think that was probably an even bigger result, because that was when I sort of started to actually think that West Ham were a real decent team, because it was that performance at Aston Villa where they played so well actually on the break, and he added a new dynamism to that midfield as well and the attacking positions, that I sort of started to believe a little bit more in their European bid.
James says, should Jose fire whoever keeps picking the defence? He said, I think for a long, long time we have problems in the team that I cannot resolve by myself as a coach. Mine and my coaching staff's methods are second to none in the world. Barry.
Well, that's demonstrably not true. They're 10th to several in the Premier League at the moment, let alone the world. And I'm not sure what to make of that statement, because it seems to be an admission that things are going really badly here at Tottenham and I don't know how to fix them. And if that is the case, then he needs to be fired, I suppose. You can't think of any Tottenham player really that he has improved as a player under his watch. Some have stayed excellent, others have deteriorated. The defence he picks, he keeps picking Eric Dier as his first choice centre half, when there are centre halves who are better, I think, are better than Eric Dier sitting on the bench. He bought Joe Roden, who doesn't seem to be getting much of a look in. I think he's a very promising player. So Jose is, you know, always good with excuses. Everything is always someone else's fault. But what we're seeing here, we've seen before at Manchester United and at Chelsea. And Jose was manager on both those occasions too.
Yeah, as regards his comments, there seems to be some confusion about that. It's pretty obvious what he's saying. He's saying there are problems in that the squad isn't good enough. And he said no coach could fit. No, this is not a coaching issue. So he's not saying I can't fix them. He's saying I haven't been given the right players, which is what this is. That's kind of stage one of his exit strategy. He spent just over 100 million on new players, but that's not really a lot if you want to finish in the top four. You probably need to spend more than that. So that's what he's doing there. And the next stage is just openly blaming the players, saying there's some sort of culture of, you know, awfulness that he, Jose, this pure spirit, is shocked to find and must clutch a perfumed handkerchief to his nose in order to avoid. But he, the thing with him is, I don't really know what we're waiting for. What's the point in carrying on? What's the beautiful vision that we're groping towards? It's not like he's some guy who wants to create a dynasty or create this beautiful template for playing football. He's someone who wants to punch a few people in the guts and nick some results before the whole thing falls apart. So all you're waiting for is the final toxic meltdown. There's no end result. There's no Eden at the end of this. It's just more Jose Mourinho. So if it's not working, there literally is no point in hanging around, because we're not building towards anything. There is no vision. There's just that face staring into the camera, saying stuff and blaming people. That's what we're waiting for, and we will have plenty more of it. Like, if you're being really pragmatic, you'd say, well, that's it. We've seen the best of it. There's no other vision. This is it.
Just on Mourinho, you know, he's paid a lot of money. He's not paid like a lower end Premier League wage. So the whole idea is that you're paying somebody that amount of money to make those players better. And so if he can't do it, as I think has already been alluded to, there's absolutely no point in being there if he needs another 200 million to spend or whatever, because then it becomes a much easier job for anyone. And they could have just given that to Pochettino to rebuild the team.
Do you think anyone will make the Mourinho mistake again, Barry?
I would say almost certainly, yes. I could envisage in the Premier League, I could envisage Wolves making the Mourinho mistake, and I would say there'll be no shortage of takers in Italy or Spain, but it is a big and expensive mistake to make, and it is monotonously predictable. You know, this was monotonously predictable. Everyone knew this was going to happen, apart from, apparently, Daniel Levy.
Arsenal 0, Manchester City 1. Jim says, should Now TV take the credit / blame for City running away with the title? Ever since we did that advert on the pod calling it the tightest title race in years, which I think is still going out, Pep's boys have been in record-breaking form to blow the league out of the water. Barney, you were there, weren't you? It was an odd football match, this. Had a sort of training ground feel to it.
Yeah, I was there. And it was really interesting. I mean, I really enjoyed the game, actually. I just enjoyed being at a football match, even though it was pretty weird, as ever. And certainly the only goal of the game, you know, which came after, I think, 77 seconds, it was really strange. It just didn't feel like it had started. I think everybody was sort of, oh, yeah, it's one of those things where we kick a ball. Oh, no, it's an actual match. It's a match. We've got to start. But Arsenal were not ready, and there was no energy at all in the stadium. I wasn't really watching. No one was watching. And there was no resistance. It's like there were no other humans on the pitch. It was very strange. But it did actually turn into a good game, I thought. And I thought Arsenal actually played okay. And it was sometimes when you're in as good a run as City are, you kind of win games because your reputation and your power goes before you. And I kind of felt that's what happened there. They got that goal because Arsenal really started behind their guard. They were a bit crouched. Like, we're facing this team, we've won 17 games in a row, and they didn't start properly. But I thought in the second half they were okay. It was very interesting to see a Man City team that was happy defending like that. They were happy defending. It wasn't a problem. We're just going to defend for a while. And even though Pep Guardiola himself acknowledges that he really, you know, he's benefited from having large amounts of money to spend so he can make the team he wants. I think it's a really great, interesting feat of modern management that he's been able to create a different team, which may be his best Man City team. It plays in a totally different way. The rhythms are different. What they're trying to do is different. He's become a pragmatist. He's decided this is the way to win this season. And I think it's really fascinating. And I think he must be really proud of the job he's done there. Like, yes, he spent lots of money, but often spending lots of money doesn't get you anywhere. And he also does, talking of Jose Mourinho, improve players and bring them back in and find them roles. And I think this Man City team, while not as engaging as the one maybe 2 years ago, is a really fascinating beast and one of his really sort of great achievements as a manager, provided they go on and complete the job and win things.
Mark, given Arsenal are below Tottenham, and given how scathing we've been about Mourinho, should we be more scathing about Arteta, or is it just a complete, it feels to me a totally different situation?
I think it is a different situation, because when Mourinho was appointed at Tottenham, the idea was that they had large parts of a team that had, you know, been pushing up the top end of the table, had reached the Champions League final, and just needed somebody to, you know, that winner to take them over the finishing line. Whereas when Arsenal appointed Arteta, you know, they knew he had absolutely no experience, was learning on the job, and it was a, you know, the long-term project that would involve some kind of pain probably. And in terms of getting players out of the club, I think they've done pretty well in that regard, but that then does become, you know, a slow process. And if you look, I think, at what he's now trying to build, you can at least see parts of a team that can be successful in the future with Tierney at left back. I mean, he was somebody that did try to exploit that space, and he was working hard up and down that left-hand side for Arsenal, being, you know, he had a lot on defensively, but he was trying to be the outlet. I think that Thomas Partey is somebody that will come on next season and be a big player for them. You've got Smith Rowe, who I wish Martin Tyler would stop calling him the Croydon De Bruyne. I mean, you know, once was more than enough, and he did it about 10 times in that game. So there are, I think, very different jobs going on there. But at the same time, you are the Arsenal manager. You're 10th. You've only won one of your last five matches in the Premier League, and you lose 1-0 against Man City, and it's seen as an acceptable result. So I think that from that point of view, definitely there's, you know, we don't sort of see Arsenal as one of those kind of top four at the moment. And so they are treated a little bit like a mid-table team, which is maybe us being a little bit too fair to Mikel Arteta.
The thing that really struck me yesterday is, because you can hear everything people shout, he shouted the word communication about maybe 20 to 25 times. After the first goal, he was shouting, not, what the hell were you doing? Why didn't anybody? He shouted communication. And it just seems like a really weird, I mean, it's an interesting, it's not quite a tautology. It's like shouting, shout, or me sitting here saying, podcast. We could all just say, podcast, interesting point. Barry could say, joke. You could say, whimsical question. It's just like a really odd thing to shout communication at people. But, I mean, it did work. The more he shouted communication, the better they started to play. So he's obviously decided communication is a thing.
Can I shout Turkey, by the way? Because while we were doing that bit, I realised that's the next place that will make a mistake with Jose. He hasn't tapped the Turkish market yet. And he will probably do well there.
On Martin Tyler, whenever he says Mane, it just makes me think Alan Brazil is saying morning. And once you've gotten that in your mind, you can't get it out. Anyway, end part one, start part two in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United 3, Newcastle United 1. Bruno Fernandes being good again. Newcastle losing again. I suppose, Barry, you know, Newcastle showed a bit of something in this game, didn't they? I'm just trying to help you not cut and paste a Newcastle answer.
They've played a lot worse this season, and they've played a lot worse and got better results. But ultimately, they just weren't good enough here. Too many of their players aren't good enough. Joe Linton got the nod this week up front, and he's not good enough. He's so not good enough, it's almost like they're playing with 10 men. And I thought he'd come good at one point, but it's not going to happen, is it? Dwight Gayle isn't good enough, I think, for the Premier League either, but at least he tries, or is seen to be trying. And there's always a chance he might get you a goal, but not with Joe Linton. Callum Wilson's a huge loss, and Manchester United are better than Newcastle. They have better players, they're a better team. But Newcastle didn't disgrace themselves, but it was a pretty predictable outcome.
McGovern writes, does Barney agree with the Newcastle players protesting about Bruno Fernandes's penalty run-up?
Yeah, I saw that. Jamal Lascelles, I really like Jamal Lascelles. He seems like a very decent, straightforward bloke. I saw him, he was making very complicated points to the referee about it. He'd obviously thought about it and he'd done some prep. And the referee was listening and nodding. It'd be very interesting to analyse Bruno Fernandes' penalty run up a little more. But I actually thought on this time it was fairly restrained. He just did a slight pause. And no idea what the problem is with that. I mean, why are you not allowed to have a pause in your run-up? What difference does it make to anything at all?
More interestingly, but Adam says, when was the last time the panel saw a keeper dive forwards on a penalty a la Carl Darlow last night? Does doing so have any purpose whatsoever? He just sort of hurled himself straight towards Bruno. He's just made it easier to score the penalty. I didn't know. I watched it a lot of times, Mark. I wasn't really sure what the analysis can be.
I mean, the idea of diving forward usually is to sort of narrow the angle. And that's one of the reasons why they stop goalkeepers from moving off their line, because you used to get them sort of really sort of moving forward and cutting off the angle. But the Darlow one, I've never seen anybody just dive forward before. It would have been beautiful had Fernandez gone for the Panenka and actually just chipped it over him while he dived forward. But what I would say is that if he would have just stood still, that he would have looked equally as foolish. And yet that is one of the three options, isn't it? To kind of stay in the middle of your goal, or to dive right, or to dive left. And you always, it always looks a bit odd if they don't go either to their right or their left. So, it was a very strange move. And I'm just disappointed that Bruno Fernandes didn't go for a cheeky chip. That would have been my favourite goal of the season.
But I don't think this was a rational moment. I think Darlow was... I felt he was trying to just leave the stadium. He was trying to just go. So he was laid bare in that moment. It's a kind of fight or flight. He just wanted to go. Football in empty stadiums in a dreadful kind of time, and his body just told him to leave, and I kind of support that decision.
Ed says, not a question, but watching Shola Shawtire, born in 2004, come on for United has made me feel incredibly old. I'm only 27. I've been listening to Football Weekly since Shawtire was 5. The 2nd of February 2004, he is 17 years old. At number one was All This Time by Michelle McManus. I watched the video.
No, it wasn't.
It was.
It wasn't, because I researched this because I knew you'd ask us, and I was hoping you'd do that thing where you offer me everything you own if I can guess what was number one.
Because
it was
if
Take
you
Me
say
to the Clouds Above by LMCVU2 versus U2.
It wasn't, because that hit number one on the 7th of February. I've already had this Twitter exchange with a person called Conrad. Take Me to the Clouds Above by LMC versus U2. Which is sampling With or Without You, yeah. I believe. That got to number one on the 7th, by which time Shola Shawtire had already had 5 days on Earth.
Right, I'm not convinced. And that Take Me to the Clouds Above samples With or Without You, and it's also a rip-off of How Will I Know by Whitney Houston.
Oh.
So does this mean I now don't get your house, all your money and your wife?
Don't get any of it, Barry.
Damn.
I don't know why I say listen. Obviously, that's what you're doing. If you haven't been doing that yet,
Arteta.
That is Mikel Arteta.
Communication, Max. Podcast.
Listen.
Michelle McManus.
Listen. Talking out loud. Fulham. Survival. Can they? 3 points separating Fulham and Newcastle now. Fulham unbeaten in 4, 2 wins, 2 draws. Some momentum there, Barney.
Yeah, they seem to be picking up points without like going on an outright win. I mean, I saw Fulham recently, and they look like a team that if they do go down, will are on an upward rather than a downward curve, and will probably come straight back. But they seem too impressive to be down there. You know, you kind of feel there's some correction still to come. And that if anyone's going to make a kind of run up the league, it's probably them. And Scott Parker seems very calm and in control, which is always nice, and handsome and smart, obviously, with wonderful cheekbones, which obviously helps. And he also gets to walk across the pitch to his dugout every time there's a game at home, which gives you these great pictures of him walking with other... They tend to walk around like it's a school game or something. They walk across and sort of whisper in each other's ears and say things. And Parker always looks so much smarter and so much more... he kind of looks like the bodyguard of the other manager, which always makes you feel like he has some kind of advantage over them, or just an early psychological edge in some way. I don't know if that comes into it at all.
Mark, Lookman and Loftus-Cheek are looking good, aren't they?
They are, and I also like the little and large midfield partnership of Reed and Anguissa as well. It's sort of a bit like Phillips and Quinn, but just in midfield, really, where Reed snaps around opponents' heels and wins the ball back. And Anguissa, a bit like Ndombele at Tottenham, just finds football so easy that he wants to make life a little bit difficult for himself sometimes and likes to dribble past people once and then twice and then maybe beat them a third time just to show them that he can. But they really don't feel like a team that's going to be relegated at the moment. If you have a look at their sort of form since the start of December, the only times they've lost in the Premier League, Manchester City, Chelsea, Manchester United and Leicester. So that's the top three plus Chelsea are in fifth. So they are definitely sort of, I think I can see them staying up. I'll backtrack on the word definitely, but I can see them staying up. I think they've got more about them than Newcastle, particularly with Callum Wilson out. And you wouldn't even rule out, say, Crystal Palace or Burnley being dragged into it from where they are. I think if Fulham can carry on playing at their current levels, they can stay up.
Barry, Sheffield United didn't get a penalty in the last minute of this match when Areola went straight through Bogle. Do you have anything to say on the matter? Talking, Barry.
Talking, penalty, red card. It's an astonishing decision. The ref clearly missed it and VAR didn't advise him to give a red card and a penalty or at least have another look. And it's just another weird decision that there's no point really in getting wound up about it. Fulham were lucky.
They were. Aston Villa 1, Leicester 2. Jack Grealish injured, believed to be out for about a month. Apparently the injury was leaked because Aston Villa players took Jack Grealish out of their fantasy football teams. Which...
Is that true?
Apparently, yeah.
It was on Twitter, wasn't it? On Friday night, there was some... there was kind of some bot accounts that sort of follow transfers in and out. And obviously, because there was a game on the Friday, everybody's teams had to be in by 6 o'clock or whatever on the Friday. And it then became clear that there were backroom staff, or it's certainly been reported that the backroom staff and players had taken Grealish out. No different to the week before when Antonio, there was a similar kind of rumour for that game against Sheffield United. So, that's where you get your injury news these days. It's on the fantasy football.
Are we going to get to a stage where, I don't know, Chelsea force N'Golo Kante to set up a fake fantasy football team where he like takes Kovacic out of his team on Friday so that whoever they're playing on Sunday evening thinks that Kovacic isn't fit?
Maybe that's the way Jose gets his mojo back. That you've just given him the plan to get back to the top.
Serge Aurier is bombed out of the squad, but all he has to do is pick loads of different fantasy football teams and keep selecting Dele and Harry Winks. Barney, Leicester, impressive again. And Jeff Peters, who's works at TalkSport and is a Leicester fan, made a point that they've had a lot of players who've missed sort of at least four games a season. A lot have missed a lot more. Justin Pratt, Vardy, Pereira, Madison and Ndidi, Fofana, Evans. They've done well. Do you like the list of Leicester players?
Can you keep saying players' names, please? Because that's essentially all the football is.
It's pretty much their whole squad. I left out
Matt Elliott, Steve Walsh, Steve Coppy, Neil Lennon.
Muzzy, is missing. The point is, they have had injury problems too, Barney.
Yeah, they've got... They continue to sign good players. So they kind of seem to be able to bring in replacements who fit their system. And, James Justin has essentially got into the team because other players have been injured. But he looks absolutely ready-made and cut from exactly the same cloth. And it's been like hugely impressive. And obviously, Brendan Rodgers deserves a great credit for making it quite clear that everybody, he doesn't seem to have a first 11 in that sense, that everybody's part of that squad. I mean, you talk about getting the most out of players. Well, he's really done that this season. You feel like he's absolutely wringing the most out of what he's got there. And they're just really good fun to watch as well. They know exactly how they want to play, and it's really progressive and full of pace and fun to watch. And Gareth Southgate always seems to be sitting in the stand, frowning behind a mask while Harvey Barnes scores a goal. That seems to be what's happening constantly every 90 minutes. They cut to Gareth Southgate frowning. Harvey Barnes scored a goal again. So I wonder what that means.
Southampton 1, Chelsea 1. That point for Southampton ends their run of six straight defeats. Nicholas says, after Edward Mendy and Cesar Azpilicueta both sat down to watch Takumi Minamino's goal at the weekend, what's the best seat you've had to watch a goal from? Mark?
I don't know about best, but certainly sort of most fun was at Punchestown. I was sat next to Gary McAllister the night that Chelsea beat Barcelona in that Champions League semi-final. Fernando Torres scored the goal. After Torres scored the goal, a lady came up to Gary McAllister and asked for a picture with him. And obviously me being the unfamous one sort of sat next to him had to play the role of photographer. So I did that. And then afterwards he said, Gary, oh, my son's going to be so pleased that I've met you. I just can't believe it. Thanks so much, Gary Pallister. And his face just dropped completely. So I don't know if it was the best. I don't know if it was the best seat necessarily, but it was certainly the most I've ever laughed in a seat watching a football match.
Ah, it's a lovely story.
You could ask the question, Max. What is Takumi Minamino doing playing for Southampton? You know, we're talking about Liverpool and their shortage of players earlier. Why is he at Southampton?
Why do you think?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. Who do you want me to ask? Barney? Is anyone? Barney, do you know?
I don't think he's such an obviously brilliantly talented striker that he should be. You know, he's the missing piece of Liverpool. I remember he played very well in the Community Shield game and played in a different run. I remember writing at the time that maybe using him as more of a number 10, a classic number 10, which seems to be a good position, might give them another option. But Diego Jota seemed to be progressing as the other option in that front three. I mean, he's at Southampton because they're a very good Premier League team and probably the right level for him, and maybe he'll get some games and do well there and come back to Liverpool. I don't think he is the missing, unless he's an incredibly good, dominant centre-half in the Virgil van Dijk mode. I don't think he is necessarily the missing piece in the jigsaw there.
The other big story from this game, Mark, was Callum Hudson-Odoi facing the ultimate insult as a footballer. The substitute being substituted. It came on at half-time, came off after 75 minutes. Tuchel has since said, maybe I was being harsh on him because he was on my side of the pitch and I was up close to him. I didn't feel he was really into the game, didn't think he was totally sharp. I took a hard decision. That decision was in the moment and for that day only. For this is absolutely not a big thing. It only becomes one if people want to talk about it. Do you want to talk about it, Mark, or not?
Well, I think, you know, the people saying about Pep Guardiola influencing on British football, I mean, I think it's Sean Dyche, isn't it? I mean, because Thomas Tuchel has just taken the lead. He saw how it worked for Sean Dyche by hooking Robbie Brady the other night, and he sort of planted the seed that, you know, this is the right thing to do if somebody comes on with the wrong attitude. I didn't feel, I mean, I wouldn't have been watching the game quite as closely as Thomas Tuchel, I wouldn't have thought, but I didn't feel like Hudson-Odoi was doing that much wrong. I don't think he was outstanding, but I'm not sure he deserved to be taken off. I mean, it felt a bit harsh to me.
Sends a message, doesn't it? Man, shame on you, Mark, for not studying the game as much as Thomas Tuchel. Berlin 0, West Brom 0. Mike says, is it the time that the Premier League pinned the staggered kickoffs? Having Burnley v West Brom as the only 3 p.m. can't be good for the product. Usually it'd be just tucked away at the end of match of the day. Producer Silas thought this was an entertaining game. I suppose it wasn't the worst 0-0, Baz, was it? There was a sending off, could have been a penalty. West Brom were better than Burnley. They're my thoughts.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. The second half was pretty decent. West Brom were better with 10 than they were with 11. Burnley were awful. Miles off, as Sean Dyche said, and West Brom should have won. They squandered several very good chances in the second half. And you'd imagine that is their goose well and truly cooked.
Mm. With apologies to Leeds fans who did another Friday night game, and they seem so long ago that we don't analyse them in great detail, but you lost to Wolves. I mean, you should know this, probably. Adama Traore's strike was wonderful, wasn't it? And then it came back in off Melier. Will has been in touch on the Leeds story. Hi, Max. I wanted to get in touch on the Leeds interpreter. He's a great guy called Andres, who I used to work with, a football betting consultancy. I covered Ligue 2 in France. He covered Ligue 1, Ligue 2 and Ligue 1, or Ligue 2 and Ligue 1. I shouldn't mix my languages, should I? Clearly a more glamorous job than me back then as well as now. It was hilarious to see him alongside Bielsa on the first day of the season, as none of my old colleagues knew about his newfound fame, which was only increased when Bielsa was telling him to translate with more passion. Anyway, just wanted to give a shout out to Andres, who I'm sure is bored of translating that Leeds are fun, aren't they?
Yeah, the great thing about that translator is he crouches down in the way that Bielsa does. When they're speaking, he also looks down. He adopts the same facial expression of intense concentration. So he could just look and say, he's saying this, but he gets into character as Bielsa. And like, I'm crouching, I'm looking down, I'm really intense. It's really funny to say you can't say those words without putting a Bielsa face on.
So there we are. That'll do for part two. Part three, little Euro roundup, bit of National League, any other business, and then we're done. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Mark, lots of big results in Europe. Atleti, who played Chelsea on Tuesday, they lost.
They did, yeah. A surprise defeat, 2-0 at home to Levante. It was un-Atleti-like, really, in the fact that they absolutely dominated the game. Had 11 shots on target to Levante's one, even though Levante scored twice. The first goal took a massive deflection, and then the second goal for Levante came when Oblak went up for a corner and then got caught out of his goal, and it was rolled in from the halfway line. I really always enjoyed those type of goals, and even better because the TV coverage I was watching had Naeem as the co-commentator, and he was explaining how difficult it was to score from the halfway line. So I mean, that was a nice moment. But the bad news for Atletico, outside of the fact that they lost and Real Madrid in very sort of Zidane mode won 1-0 away at Valladolid, was the fact that Jimenez, their star centre-back, one of their most important players, he suffered an injury in that game, highly unlikely to play against Chelsea in midweek. So that's another blow for Atletico that are already missing Carrasco, the left wing back, Kieran Trippier, unable to play at the moment. Vasalco, another wing back as well, he's been missing. So Atletico got a few issues. Even João Félix, who's been one of their star players this season, only just come back from COVID as well, so maybe not 100%. So Atletico not in a stronger place as what they were in La Liga, say, a couple of weeks ago, because they also dropped points last midweek. Barcelona continued their very iffy form with a 1-1 draw against Cadiz. And quite remarkably, the goal was scored by Alex Rodriguez, who is the brother of Nacho, who plays for Real Madrid. So it was celebrated quite strongly, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. Also, just another great picture of Messi looking forlorn when that equaliser went in. Bayern lost in the Bundesliga. That always seems a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, Bayern defensively have not been good for a while now. They've conceded 31 goals after they lost 2-1 against Eintracht Frankfurt. That's the most of any team in the top five in the Bundesliga. Once again, started really poorly. They were 2-0 down. A fantastic goal from Yunus put Eintracht Frankfurt 2-0 up. Sané, some brilliant work down the wing, pulled it back for Lewandowski to make it 2-1. But Bayern so often have been able to kind of retrieve these losing positions and pick something up, usually a win. They were unable to do that this time around. So Leipzig, who won 3-0 at Hertha, are only 2 points behind now. So what looked like being a stroll at one stage is anything but. And it really, in terms of sort of the chasing pack and for the Champions League spots, really tight at the moment. Eintracht have now won 9 of their last 10 matches. Dortmund won the derby 4-0 against Schalke. Haaland scored a bicycle kick. It was quite a slow bicycle kick, but it was still another wonderful goal from him. He's now scored 43 goals in 43 games for Dortmund. And Jadon Sancho was also on the score sheet. He's now become the quickest player ever to get to 35 Bundesliga goals. So a really impressive performance from Dortmund, backing up what had happened in the midweek Champions League, which was an excellent result away to Sevilla.
For all the talk of Haaland and Mbappe last week, Lukaku is having an absolutely brilliant season, isn't he? And you know, into winning the Milan derby and looking great.
Yeah, so they're now 4 points clear of Milan at the top, and Lukaku was just unplayable. He set up the first goal, a wonderful cross into Lautaro Martinez, who couldn't miss. Martinez then made it 2-0. And Lukaku's third goal on the break, so powerful, so brilliant. You know, I think he was somebody that people have always questioned his technique, or certainly they have in terms of the Premier League, and whether his first touch was good enough and stuff like that. But I don't know if it's just improvement as he's getting older, whether he needed somebody like Conte to... Conte's on him constantly to be better every game. They've also changed his diet. He looks quicker as much as anything else. And he's the catalyst behind what looks like being a really strong title push now. Because like I say, they're 4 points clear of Milan, who are heading backwards quickly. They made a really fast start, but always felt like it was unsustainable, and that's now sort of ringing true. So a massive opportunity for Inter to win the league, because Juventus are well back. Napoli lost 4-2 at Atalanta. Roma drew with Benevento. So a big weekend, I think, for Antonio Conte's side and Lukaku.
Simon says, can someone in the panel explain the situation in the National League? I've read the official statements. I still have no idea. So here's what happened. The National League, which for people who don't know it, might be not in the UK, is the division below League Two. That's going to continue despite 7 of the 23 clubs voting to end the season. National League North and South clubs voted 24-19 in favour of ceasing the season with immediate effect. So it was declared null and void. There will be no relegation from the National League. Some clubs have got reserves, some don't. So in the National League, we've got teams like Kings Lynn and Dover saying they can't afford to carry on. They were meant to play at the weekend. Obviously, fining them is not a good idea because they don't have the money. And docking points doesn't make any sense because there's no relegation. Chesterfield have furloughed some of their players because they need to save the money. And there's no relegation. So if you don't have your best players, that doesn't necessarily matter. In National League South, Dorking are 5 points clear at the top. In the National League North, Gloucester are 5 points clear at the top. They're both unhappy. It is a total mess. Ollie Bayliss has done loads of work on this. He sent a Freedom of Information Act to the government, to the DCMS, asking for the minutes of that meeting. You'll remember we discussed it last week about whether it was a grant or a loan. The government saying it was a loan. The league saying they left that meeting thinking it would be a grant. He made three requests. The DCMS said it would have required more than 3.5 days work to find the minutes of the meeting, and it would cost £600, and so they couldn't do it. Well done to James Coppinger, who designed the kit for the Doncaster game to celebrate his 17th and final season at the club. He'd been injured. He came off the bench and scored a brilliant free kick in like the 10th minute of injury time to get a point against Hull. Well done to him. And Jack says, what food or drink item will Ryan Shawcross bring to dinner with him on his first evening at Chateau Beckham? 2 cheese and bacon oat cakes, he says. Chris Henderson says, Ryan fits the Inter Miami DNA because of his experience and longevity at a club. He's going to be able to come here and be a leader, not only on the field, but his leadership will be seen with the young players and players coming through.
Oh, hang on. Was that a serious point, that he fits the DNA? That wasn't a joke. Like this invented David Beckham franchise apparently has a DNA, which Ryan Shawcross, of all people, is perfect for. But okay, that's a serious point. Okay, fine.
That is the serious point. Well, I suppose I was thinking about this going, you know, they can't have a DNA yet, but clearly DNA is one of the first things that happens, isn't it? I'm not a doctor or a scientist, but, you know, isn't the DNA there from quite early on?
I guess so, but it's now fixed as Ryan Shawcross DNA. So that means that for the until they can evolve suitably, there'll be Ryan Shawcross FC forever, because he is now their
it's
DNA.
It's not that type of DNA.
Hey, Baz, you've got some news. We've obviously discussed Gandhi. You've got some news on the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, hot on the heels of our revelation that Gandhi was a West Ham fan. Listener John Ashburn has been in touch from Japan to tell me that the Dalai Lama is a Bradford City fan.
Oh, great.
I was unaware of this, but apparently he was at a conference in Yorkshire some years ago and someone presented him with a Bradford City shirt with his name across the shoulders. And then when Bradford City became the first League Two side in God knows how many years to reach the League Cup final, he sent them a letter wishing them every success and said that he'd pray for them. And they proceeded to lose 5-0 against Swansea. So I don't know if he was tuning in to see James Coppinger score his late equaliser against Bradford on Saturday, but yeah. So if you know of any other spiritual leaders or religious figures who have an affinity for English Football League teams, please keep us informed.
Yeah, I was wondering if it said, did it say Lama like Bernard Lama on the back, or Dalai like Delhi? But it's I've just been producer side has shown me the shirt. It says Dalai Lama number 14. So yeah, that's
because I think he's the 14th Dalai Lama, isn't he?
Okay, so that's now in the Bradford City DNA, isn't it? Whose DNA would you rather, the Dalai Lamas or Ryan Shawcross's? The question. and finally, give the people what they want. James, has Mark eaten any veg covered in butter lately? Please try cauliflower cheese; it will blow your mind.
I haven't had cauliflower cheese. Cauliflower is very strong, isn't it? It's been on a plate, and you can kind of just get little bits of it. And I don't like cauliflower. I do like cheese. So my sort of whole attitude towards food is to eat stuff that you do like and leave stuff that you don't. So I'll eat the cheese, and I won't eat the cauliflower if it's okay with James. I had some carrots yesterday because I knew I was coming on the pod, and I knew there'd be a question. So I went to Tesco and I bought some baby carrots. They were as the name alludes, they were only small. They made absolutely no difference to the dinner whatsoever. So completely pointless. I won't.
What did you put them in?
I put quite a bit of pepper on them and ate them with some Yorkshire pudding, but it made no difference to my life. So, I mean, there's no point in them, is there?
Marvellous. Well, listen, that'll do for today. I think we've covered a lot of ground. Barney, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's a pleasure. Mark Langdon, thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry Glendenning.
You're welcome, Max.
We'll be back with the Josimar special on FIFA on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.